I want to tell you about something I've used and I truly believe in. Replayer. It's a sideline camera built for youth sports. Just set it up, hit record, and it captures the entire game automatically. No chasing the ball, no holding your phone, just hands-free, stress-free recording. The in-game tagging is one of my favorite features. One tap, and you can mark a big goal, ankle-breaking moves, or a clutch tackle. Then pull those clips for later for review, highlights, or social media. And the live streaming's next level. A buddy of mine actually watched his son's game while flying cross-country at 30,000 feet. That blew me away. If you're a parent or coach at the field every weekend, Replayer is a game changer. Head to replayer.com. That's R-E-E-P-L-A-Y-E-R.com. And I think you'll be amazed. Hey, soccer friends. I just want to give a shout out to our partner, TeamPlayer. They are changing the game on how you find the perfect soccer team for your player. Parents, this means no more endless social media scrolling to find information on teams. With TeamPlayer, everything you need to know is just a few clicks away. It's simple, straightforward, and lets you find the best coach and team for your player without any of the usual headaches. And coaches, we all know how tough it can be to get your team noticed, but when you subscribe to one of TeamPlayer's team plans, you instantly get access to set up an online team profile that allows you to reach more potential players and showcase what your team is all about. It's super easy and lets players and parents see why your team could be the right fit for them. And if you sign up using the promo code PITCH, you can try any team plan free for 1 month. So whether you're managing a team or searching for one, come on over to www.teamplayer.us. That is TeamPlayer.us. And come give TeamPlayer a look.
Family-owned Soccer Innovation is your go-to source for top-quality equipment. Whether you're a player, a supportive family member, or a dedicated coach, they have everything you need to elevate your game. For players, their innovative equipment are designed to boost your skills and performance on the pitch. From their agility cones to their portable goals, they have you covered. And family members, they offer durable equipment that's built to last because we know your support is critical to your player. Coaches, trust me, they can provide the equipment you need to run effective training sessions and shape the next generation of soccer players. Visit Soccer Innovations at soccerinnovations.com to start elevating your game with them.
And if you use the code PITCH, P-I-T-C-H, you can receive up to 10% off your next order.
Hello and welcome back to Chat by the Pitch. This is Ian Babcock, your host. This week is part two with Tyler Held. Now, I'm not going to give too much detail. We're just going to start this episode. So let's start this chat and head to the pitch. Disclaimer, this podcast provides informational content only and does not replace professional mental health services, diagnosis, or treatment. If you are someone in crisis, please contact your local emergency service or the National Suicide Prevention Line at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255 in the United States. The host and the guest are not responsible for outcomes of actions taken based on information discussed. Listener's discretion is advised, and we encourage seeking appropriate professional assistance for mental health concerns.
Expectation of players, and how do you advise parents to have conversations with their players when their coaches demand such a high level of, not perfection, but doing their best? Like, the coaches know the players as well as we know our players. We just know their body language better or things along that line than their coaches. But their coaches might yell at them, and the players internalize their coaches yelling at them because they aren't pleasing their coach now, and now they feel like a failure. But at the end of the day, most coaches they're on the pitch, they are this fire-breathing dragon. Then once you get off the pitch, practice, training's done, games are done, they are the most softest teddy bear in the world. It's, but how do we teach our kids that their coaches demand this from them and it's okay to fail then? Because, and or how do we change the culture of this then? Because I know it stems from the parents and parents have to demand it, but at the end of the day, every parent wants that Gucci athlete that they can wear on their shoulder on their Facebook, Instagram, or whatever it may be, showing how great their kid is. But in reality, their kid is shriveled up inside with no confidence or severe anxiety or whatever it may be. It's, I don't know how to ask the question I'm trying to get
No,
to.
I think I'm on track with you. And the first thing that I'm gonna say that again, maybe is an unpopular opinion, but I believe that the first question every parent should be asking as soon as their kid gets in a car after a practice, after a game, is, did you have fun? Right? Because that opens up the door of like, hey, I actually didn't have as much fun today because my coach was doing this thing and it just wasn't working for me, and a lot of anxiety resulted, right? Not that a 9-year-old is going to be able to articulate that as well, but at least give them the space to be open about how the pressure from the coach is affecting them. And then the second thing that I would talk about, just from a basic mental skills training perspective, is how engaged are you or is your athlete in goal setting, and what type of goals are you setting? So when I talk about goal setting, there are three different layers of goals. Outcome goals. We want to go win this game today. We want to score X amount of goals, like, get X amount of assists. Like, this is the outcome of what we're doing. There's performance goals. So the easiest example of performance goals is like if you're trying to run a 100-meter dash, what time are you clocking in? That is a performance, right? Because you could still be sixth place and increase your time by a second. So it's not really an outcome, it's your performance. And then there's process goals. It's what are you actually doing and working on? And so where that coach's criticism might come in is in regard to process goals, right? Instead of taking those coaches' expectations and maybe they're yelling in the heat of the moment as criticism, as failure, I can take it as information into what kind of goals I should be setting for my next practice, right? And every athlete should set process goals for everything that they are doing. The difference between the athlete that practices, let's say, 6 hours a week and sees improvement versus the athlete that practices 10 hours a week and doesn't seek improvement is deliberate practice, right? Deliberate practice requires feedback. Process goals gives us this threefold layer and system of, first of all, it's going to help me know what I need to focus on this practice, right? I'm going to do an inventory. These are the things that I didn't do so well in my last game. So these are the three things that I'm going to focus on in my practice. Fast forward to in practice, that helps me with this mindfulness thing that we've been talking about. Because if I feel my thoughts start to wander or I feel myself start to get too emotional, I can go back into really task-focused process goals that I'm completely in control of. And then when I'm sitting in the car with my dad, I can talk about, here's the three process goals that I set for myself. Here's the ways that I was successful in them. And here's the ways that maybe I needed to work a little bit harder. And it takes it away from being this, like, I don't know with my performance, into a really systematic approach to, the things that we think about, the conversations that we have, and the way that we react to pressure coming from teammates, other parents, our coaches, anything else, because that really boils down to, you know what? My coach was upset, but that's something that I need to work on. Maybe I need to set some goals for this. And how can I make those goals really specific instead of just, I need to get better, I need to get better? Like, what do you need to do to get better?
I really like that because it makes, you mentioned practicing with a purpose. I think many coaches have really good intention, and this is a conversation that I've learned, is that your practices should be, when I actually coached Landon for about a year, year and a half. And that was one of the things that was heavily talked about when he got your coaching licenses, was going to practice with a game plan, going in. But I never really thought about it as an athlete, because the athletes need the same thing, set their own expectations. Being a coach, like, you go in and you have your goals that you have lined up. I want to see this type of movement in practice. I want to see them getting this down. But as an athlete, I didn't think, tells you, one track mind here, you think of it only on your side of the equation. Now, that's amazing. And you talked about desired outcomes. So I interviewed a coach here, and he was telling me about how it is in Europe. And this might blow your mind how backwards we are here in the United States, or not shocked, depending on who's listening. So in the English Premier League, their academies, when they scrimmage, they don't keep scores. Well, if it's an in-house scrimmage, they don't keep score. What they're keeping score of is the tasks they have learned in practice, and if they're executing them. That's how they get points. It's not by scoring a goal. The goal is the byproduct of actually achieving what you're training to do. So the score of the game doesn't matter. But were you able to execute a play, so to speak, or a motion, or whatever it may be in practice? And here in the United States, the winners do push-ups, the winners do nothing, and the losers do push-ups or jumping jacks or go do a sprint or something. And there it's, no, you guys didn't accomplish it. So the losing team now has to go execute it, go practice it for 10 minutes by themselves. You guys get a break because your team was able to execute what we were driven. It wasn't, they didn't want to go to the coach and ask what the score of the game was. Coach, did we earn a point by executing the overlap drill that we've been working on in our game? Because we scored a goal. And I think that's the different mindset, but now it goes back to having that, learning not to have that perfection mentality of having to execute it perfectly every time. It's about how you handle the mistake.
Well, and then you're punishing the kid that maybe took everything to heart that they're supposed to practice on. And sometimes, like to your point with the squiggly line, sometimes you have to break down your skills to build them back up. So if I'm paying really mindful attention to something new that I'm learning in practice, it might come at a cost of goals, right? It might come at a cost of another skill, but that's how learning works, right? Part of my education is in motor learning and performance. And when we're learning something new, we have to pay a lot of mental energy and focus to it, right? I have to try really hard to execute that skill. And the goal is that when I do that enough times, it's going to come automatically to me in a game, right? That's mindfulness is also a lot of times associated with what we call a flow state. And a flow state is merging of action and awareness, right? You are just performing. You are just doing the things. And practice is supposed to be a space where we can slow down and make mistakes, because those mistakes are the feedback that help program our brain to do the right things in the high pressure circumstance. So when you've got this sort of, okay, we're going to put half the team against half the team and the loser's going to have to do push-ups. All right, the kid that made some mistakes because he was really working hard on something and trying hard, so he maybe went out of his peak performance state to build a skill, which, by the way, is what practice is supposed to be about. Now he's getting punished. And I think that is a really difficult thing to wrap your head around when you are just in the mindset of outcome goals, right? And I think my first couple of months of playing around with, like, working with clients and stuff like that, I was like, oh, you don't even need to have an outcome goal. But we do. We like to win. We like to win ribbons. We like to win medals. We like to win trophies. So now I have the approach of, like, yeah, have the outcome goal, have the idea to win, but how are you breaking that down into smaller and manageable chunks? And when I talk about those process goals, I want people to be setting process goals, not just from the technical perspective, but also the mental perspective, also the physical perspective. What do I need to do? That's all you can train: your body, your craft, and your mind. So what can I do physically, mentally, and technically to get me closer to where I want to be as an athlete? And let me make my definition of an athlete so much deeper than someone that goes and wins.
That takes a culture change to have that mentality. Yeah. And yep. I think this is where we're coming to a collision course. At least here in North Texas. I don't know if about rest of the world, but I can say that it's spilling over to the parents and the fans in this watching matches. I mean, players will make derogatory comments to the parents that make derogatory comments to them, and it just escalates. And then there's fist fights at the soccer fields, or even better cases are with officials. Parents will make comments to the point that they're now threatening an official officiating the game, and now the game comes to a halt. And
yep,
it blows my mind. Like, I will yell at a ref, but I also will approach the ref. Like I said the other day, yesterday at my son's game, it was, I made a comment to him before the game, what gets calls my way, jokes or money? And he looks at me because I'm not even answering that one. And, but that's the thing, like, you have to have an approach. And he walked by me later in the game, goes, yeah, you're really quiet. I go, I've been biting my tongue because I don't want to get kicked out. And because I also look at it as I have to be an example for my kid. And I struggle with that. Like, we go to, I'm wearing my FC Dallas hat today. We go to the professional team and watch them play quite a bit. If I think there's a bad call, we are three rows up from the field, from the pitch. And I will yell, I won't curse, but I'll ask him like if he's blind or if he needs his fitness checked again, or if I'm wearing glasses that day, I'll ask him if he wants to wear my glasses, or I know he can't hear me, but it makes me feel better. And we need to move away from that mentality as parents of our kids are always watching our behavior and watching how we talk. And yes, I'm at a professional match and I'm one of 20,000 people there, but my kid sees me acting this way. So when he's in his game, will it apply to him in the same way, or does he have enough distinguish ability to separate the two? Like, this is a pro match and this is a kid's match. And I don't think kids really at any age understand the difference
anymore.
I think they can go to a pro match and act one way and go to their game and act the same way. As a parent, I worry that this behavior of mine going to a pro match will affect him at his personal level matches, or me saying that's like, I don't yell about handballs unless it's blatantly obvious. I mean, like if it's in the goal box and results in a PK or a certain, like I'm getting to the point where I care more about the safety side of the game than I am about the other aspects that are fouls. It's funny because we are in a society now where they're struggling to get any official to do any sporting events, baseball, soccer, football. And now we are seeing the consequences of it by not having the higher grade officials on the pitch. And us as parents, goes back to that ego side of the conversation, is that we see our kids as these mini pro athletes out there, and really they're just kids. I don't care if they're 18 years old, they're still kids. If they don't have that professional contract under their belt, they're still kids. Even then, some of these players are kids, and our parent ego kicks in saying that we expect X, Y, and Z from officials. But I can't imagine some of the pressure these kids have when you watch some of these parents of how they berate officials, how they berate their kids when they get in the car. And it comes back to culture and society. Like, some of these people are from soccer families from other side of the world, and their parents may be very vocal on referees, but when they get in the car, they aren't that way. And I, as a person, I will not, I'm getting better as a dad of, instead of berating my kid, I start asking questions. Why did you do this? Like, what was your train of thought through this process? You did this wrong. It is, I saw you you do this in the game, why did you do this? Like, what was your train of thought in that moment? Do you remember? If not, it's okay. We can talk about something else. Versus saying you did this wrong is to better understand so you can ask the questions later to help build them back up. This actually came from a sports psychologist that actually talked about having conversations with questions versus statements when talking, trying to build your player back up. The only time I do not ask questions is when he treats people poorly, if it's an official or a teammate. And the big one for us for a long time is how he talks. He yells at his teammates, but the yelling he's doing is not in a nice tone.
Right.
And he's not meaning like he's angry at him, but it could be taken wrong. As a parent of my child, I took it wrong. He goes, I'm not angry at him. I just want them to move up. I want them to do their role in the game. And he gets frustrated, and then, but he's no longer screams. He uses a more, I call it, he no longer uses his dad yelling voice, air quotes. He's using just a yelling voice.
Yep.
And then as an athlete, when he makes a mistake, we have tried to instill him. It's like mistakes happen. It's the recovery. But he has teammates, and we watch other teams that he plays against. If they make a mistake, their first thing these kids do is put their face in their hands.
Yep.
And there's still a game going on. And it's like, how do you, other than cheering on all the kids, how do you encourage parents to be more helpful with this on the sidelines? Because I know I'm taking a drastic switch here, but parents on the sideline can drastically affect the mood of a game. If you're down 4-0 and you're no longer, their parents aren't cheering for them anymore, the energy for the players isn't there. But then the mindset goes to the players. It's like, I'm making too many mistakes and we're losing because of my mistakes.
Yeah. And I think that's like, you know, kind of a twofold question. I think parents need to be able to supply their athletes with the coping skills to handle the mistakes in action, right? Whether that be from working one-on-one with a mental performance coach, having a mental performance coach come in and talk to the team about how to do that, or, you know, just making it a more acceptable thing, right? There's pre-performance routines and there's in-performance routines. And in-performance routines help us deal with those split-second emotional reactions of like, hey, like I'm sitting with my hands and my face in my hands. Okay, the other team's going to read that and they're going to be like, great, like they're defeated. I'm going to start to attack because they can't cope with the failure that they're making. And so like pitchers will do something like take dirt off the mound and throw it on the ground and like physically wipe away the mistake. But to your point, soccer is much more of a go, go, go sport. And so I have like basically have encouraged my athletes that I work with to have a sort of process and have a sort of routine of like, let yourself have that split second frick moment, right? Let yourself feel the emotions for 1 to 3 seconds of like, oh, that sucks, because I'm not one to ever say we should suppress emotions. And then you immediately have to go and finish the movement, the play, the quarter, the half, whatever you're in, like you need to go finish because you don't have time for this right now. Like go finish. And then like let yourself off the hook, right? And that's where I think parents come into play is like forgive the mistakes so that the players feel like they can actually get better and grow and they don't just compound all this negative feeling, right? Because if I'm already upset that I made a mistake and my parent, I look over and my parent has a just horrible look on their face, like they're disappointed or they're angry at me, even worse, how am I supposed to bring my attention back to the game? And that's like literally the next step is how can I focus and direct my attention back to how I can perform better? What are some physical and mental cues that help snap me back into what's going on the pitch? Because parents are not playing the game, right? And so when you're reactions and your emotions are affecting how your kids feel, right? I can notice positive and negative parents just by going observing a group game, and it's really simple. A kid will make a mistake and they'll look to their parents to see the reaction, right? They're looking to see how they should feel about themselves based on what their parent is doing on the sidelines. And that is the opposite of mindfulness. That is the opposite of being where you are, doing what you need to do. It's, I'm going to go look at my parent to see how I can feel about this. Instead of going through this, all right, I'm going to say frick for a second. I'm going to finish what I'm doing. I'm going to forgive it. I'm going to focus and I'm going to fix it. And I'm going to keep playing and I'm going to keep moving and I'm going to keep going, right? As soon as a parent has enough sway on their child that the child is looking to the parents for either approval or disapproval of their actions, you have already messed up. And that's the conversation I would have before the game starts of like, look, I know we're on the sidelines. We're here to cheer you on. We want you to have fun, but like, this is your game. You got to keep your head on the pitch, right? And if my child looks over to me, I'm going to mouth, head on the pitch, head on the pitch, head on the, like, yeah, I'm not playing the game, right? I'm just a parent. I'm observing. I think that's the, you know, that's the deeper conversation of parents living vicariously through their children's, isn't it?
I'm guilty of it, but my son and I have, sorry for all the parents out there. I'm going to try to censor this a little bit, but if you play like crap, if you practice like crap, you play like crap. And I use the curse word in the equation. I don't say crap. But I have a saying I say to him, I say, please. And he knows what it means. It's not saying, it just means get out there and work harder. It's not, he just knows that I see him not doing what he needs to be doing. I mostly use it in training. I don't use it in games because games are a completely different thing. Like it's a game. It's a practice statement to me. It's like, go out there and give it your all in your training, because when you get to your game, if you don't give it all in your training, you're doing a practice. You're doing a play your games like you train and, or you practice, however you want to say it. And I try to instill in him that, like, hey, look, I use examples from the national team. Christian Pulisic had a conversation with the head coach, and he goes, why don't you go practice like the same way you play in your games with that same intensity? And it really changed his perspective and how he practices now and how hard he pushes himself in his games. I think Kobe Bryant is one of the best examples of this. It's the man eat, lived, and breathed and crafted his skills. The stories of Mamba, I think it's Black Mamba, whatever you called him, his personality, like he would go out to eat and it would set a place for him, his ego, to have a seat at the table. And I'm like, I don't know if it's true or not, it was just his way of saying, like, it's part of me, but it's not who I am. It's with me everywhere I go. But this is the same man that would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go shoot 3,000 shots before he goes practices for the day. And I use Cristiano Ronaldo. I think as much as I talked about him having ego, he also, the other side of the ego equation for him, he just won the largest national European, championship league, and which is clubs from all over Europe competing for in a league, and his team won it. And someone asked him about his Cristiano Ronaldo, what was he doing the next day, or what was his plan the next day? He was getting up at 4 a.m. to go start working out. You can't ever not be improving. And I think as parents, we get caught up in this moment of, we have little pro athletes. No, we have little kids or teenagers. And they're going to be pro athletes if they have the natural given talent to be. And I think we as parents think all of our kids, I talk about it with Landon. I go, his first word wasn't mom or dad. It was ball. The first toy he moved around the house was a ball, swatting it and crawling to it and moving it around the house. And it's like, we joke in our house, it's like, he's going to be an athlete someday. But at the end of the day, if he's not, if it's tomorrow he says he's done with soccer, I'll be crushed.
Yep.
But he better be filling that activity with something else, because as a parent, I don't want a kid not doing something. And yep. I'm waiting for the day that both my kids tell me they're done playing soccer. But I have to grieve that moment in life. But living, going back to what you're saying, like the view of our kids on the sideline, them looking over at to us. I have a coach that told me, if a kid looks over at his parents for approval after they make a mistake or make a goal, I don't have him on my team.
Yep.
And he goes, the parents have too much sway on that player. And it's like I will always look at my son. Like if he's looking at me for whatever reason during the game, I'll give him a thumbs up. Like we have different, like I'll give him like a shoulder shrug with a thumbs up, like how are you doing? And he'll give me thumbs up. I'm like, okay, like just like I'll do like an emotion of like breathe and to him. But it's not to say like that he's looking for approval. It was, I think I just caught his eye and he's looking at me and I give him a thumbs up. It's because a good soccer player should always be scanning. But if he catches my eye in a down moment, but it's like, I don't know. It's like, as a parent, I worry about him on the pitch where he's mentally at now. It's not so much technically or physically at, it is where he's at mentally, because I think we're coming to the age of mindfulness and mental toughness is becoming the more important in his soccer journey versus the athletic side. And every athlete hits that moment. It's just a matter of when. And I really like what you talked about in the very beginning of visual imagery and how important imagery is. If you can't imagine doing it, you can't actually do it then. And maybe this is the difference between a high level pro athlete and just an athlete, is that the high level pro athlete can visualize themselves doing it and then they can move on and actually do it and actually go out and actually practice to do it and become an expert on it. I think that's the difference between wrapping this whole equation together. It is going from the beginning to the end and figuring out how each place ties together. And as parents, we need to take time to do this. I think having conversations with coaches, the more I've done this, like I was telling you before, I have a coach that I talked to. His son played in the English Premier League. And one of the things, it's like his kids knew before he even said anything, I should have made that goal. He goes, you're right, you should have. And he goes, next time, get it. It was not to dwell on it, go do it next time. It was always, and listening to this conversation really made me really think, because he was not talking about dwelling on that moment. It was dwell on it for the second and move on to the next moment. It's, I think we as parents, like you said, negative mindset. We as people, as society, you talked about it, it is remember pain than more than positive things. There's some pain that I'll never understand, like giving birth, and moms forget that moment of giving birth. But like getting an injury, banging your hand or burning your finger, you'll always remember. And those are the moments that are getting a broken arm or cut. You remember those moments, but that winning that one goal, having that great goal my son had yesterday, he might not remember that in a year from now, maybe 2 years from now. It would just be part of who he is. But he'll remember him having an emotional breakdown in the middle of the game more than the goal.
And I'm glad like that you kind of you brought up Kobe Bryant, and it's so funny to use these elite athletes as our recipe for success, right? There is a mental performance book called Relentless: From Good to Great to Unstoppable by Tim
Yes.
Grover, right?
Great book.
And
Great book.
Kobe's in it. There is a literal chapter in that book that says these athletes that are unstoppable are so driven, so focused, and so unhinged that there is a piece of them that is broken. That they most of the time also come with some sort of addiction, whether it be gambling, alcohol, sex, whatever. Like there is a chapter in that book that outlines that. And so there are pieces of that book that I love, right? I love this idea that we should all work hard. David Goggins is another great example, right? He tells us, oh, you can think more, do more, be more. But he comes through the ultra marathon races, literally having to go to the hospital because his kidneys are failing, right? Like he's done these challenges. And so again, going back to that cultural shift, success at what cost, right?
Right.
And when you're thinking of your 9-year-old and the pressure that you're putting on them, do you want them to have that pressure that feels like, okay, yes, to succeed, you have to work so hard that you put yourself in the hospital, or you have to stress yourself out so much that you need an outlet like gambling or drugs or alcohol to feel normal and to feel full. And that's, again, you know, my personal kind of input and outlook on the world is that you have to really determine what success means to you. I want to be on the podiums of big jiu-jitsu tournaments, but if I'm in silver because I didn't kill myself to get there, because I didn't work through an injury, because I didn't, you know, grind through when I wasn't feeling my best, that's okay. There is a line between elite performance and wellness that you have to cross. And if you're making that sacrifice at 9 years old, what is that kid going to look like when they're 50, right? If you're already pushing through a sprained ankle and like being like, oh, like this effort above all else, we're just going to keep working through, we're going to keep working through. Like, you can only work through so many injuries before your body legitimately stops working. And so, again, I think there's levels and there's layers to it of, yeah, it's great to aspire to be wonderful, but just know that the cost of success from societal athletic terms isn't always what it's cracked up to be. There's an amazing documentary that Michael Phelps put together called The Weight of Gold that talks about all of the mental pressures that athletes go through with little bits of salaries and injuries and stuff like that. Another great book is Little Girls in Pretty Boxes, and it's about gymnasts and ice skaters and the things that they go through. And it's like literally like 10-year-old girls getting paralyzed, and it really opens your eyes, right? As a human being, I don't have kids, right? As a human being, when I think of putting my kid in under so much pressure to perform and work through injury that they might make a mistake that paralyzes them forever, like, whoa, let's like check ourselves there. But that's just, you know, again, that's a whole bigger overarching conversation that we need to have as a society and that we need to have as parents of like, okay, like, am I checking in on my kid's mental health as much as I'm checking in on their performance, right? How did their bad performance affect them today? Do they think less of themselves because of what happened in a game? And, you know, you can boil it back down to the mental skills of confidence, right? Does your kid have confidence to go play in a game, to go play their best, and feel like they can do that with a healthy, adaptive mindset? One of my favorite quotes, I always use the term competence with confidence, right? Like, if you're not competent in what you're doing, why should you be competent? And that really comes from my background with equestrian sports, because it's a legitimately dangerous sport, right? I work with eventers, and there's these big solid fences, and people legitimately die over those fences, right? And so, to me, if you're not competent, why be confident? Same thing with the gymnasts I work with. If you're not competent in doing a double back handspring to a backflip, why should you be confident? And I actually stumbled upon a quote from another mental performance coach that sort of solidifies that. And he said, one of the biggest errors we have made in elite sports is we use the word confident when we actually mean competent. I can't sing. I'm not competent at singing. Put six beers in me at a karaoke bar, and now I'm confident, but I'm still terrible at singing, right? Like, it doesn't change. Confidence doesn't change your skills and your abilities. And that kind of goes full circle back to, you know, being oriented towards the task. It really reinforces the skills and the abilities. And it's not hating yourself for the skills and abilities that aren't there yet. It's getting excited about building them for the future.
Right. Oh my gosh. There's so much to unpack there. because you talk about these players that perform at such a high level that they're broken inside. Michael Jordan had a huge gambling issue.
Yep.
I don't know much about Kobe Bryant. I mean, I have my opinion on it. I'm not going to bring it up, but Michael Jordan actually talked about it in his, on his documentary. It's like he would go gamble playing golf and It's what he did when he played golf. That was just what he did when he played golf. But he was highly successful. But he also made up stories. He talked about in his documentary that he'd made up stories about him, about opposing players to motivate him to want to overdrive them, to outperform them, because whatever the story he concocted in his mind about this player before that game. I'm just trying to think, like, I honestly understand what you're saying. Like, the perform at a high level is these players, I'm stuck on that part. Because I feel like as parents, we get stuck there.
Yep.
That our players have to be pros at 6 and 7. And I asked coaches this question. I went and asked several coaches. Now it goes back to what I was telling you about. What do you think is more important, keeping score or keeping score via things they're performing well in the game versus the end results? And he goes, that'll never happen in our society because it is, we're so driven on winning here in the United States. Everything's a competition, everything is a win, has to win. If we don't win, we're failures. I think the Ricky Bobby quote that everyone loves to quote from I can't think of the name of the movie right now, but Talladega Nights, there we go.
Yep.
And he talks about if you aren't number one, you're last. And I think we have embraced that mentality in our society so much that we ingrain it into our kids. Now, we talk a lot about the Olympics in our house when they're going on. And my wife made a comment to me one time and it just clicked in my head. She goes, if you got bronze in the Olympics and you're not happy, I think there's something might be slightly wrong with you because I'm paraphrasing what she's saying. You're third best in the whole world in this one event in that 4 year gap. Now your goal might be to go get gold next time, but at your third best in the whole world. Like, how much of an ego boost would that be? We're struggling for the last year to even place to get into the Olympics. So yeah, I don't know. I think we could sit here and talk for days on this topic. It's close and dear to my heart because I see athletes hand struggling with the mental side of the game. If you can't, I really like your definition of mindfulness. And if you can't be in a judgment, non-judgmental moment, you can't be successful. I honestly think if we as parents and coaches understood that more, I think we'll be better out ahead. I think I can actually say it correctly this time, and I'm sorry for everyone that's listening. And we jump back when I was telling you about kids wanting to appease parents and coaches at a younger age. It goes back to they only care about making those people happy in their life because that's who's important to them. We as parents drive and coaches drive these players' happiness at the end of the day, indirectly or intentionally. And if we can learn that, like you've talked about, being that parent on the sideline that be supportive and they aren't looking for support. Yesterday when my son made his goal, it was like I don't even think he looked at us until after he got done celebrating because he wasn't expecting to make the goal. But his
Yep.
hands are like he was just running down the field, like he was like, oh my goodness, I just made that shot. And but then he looked over at us and we're like giving him thumbs up. But I think we as parents dictate all of this for our players, especially at a young age. And if we can do the things you talked about, help teach that mindset, visualization, the imagery work that we need to be with our athletes, I think we'll get farther ahead. My favorite question to ask is, since you are an athlete, and what has been your greatest influence on you as an athlete to be where you're at today? And now switching over to your professional career outside of sports, who has influenced you to be the best doctor in your subject matter expertise, to be who you are today with that?
So I would say that for like sports and honestly life in general, my dad has been such a huge influence. He is a business person, and I think he really, without even knowing it, praised the task-oriented type stuff, right? The stuff that you're completely in control of. If you show up every day and work hard, the results will come. And he, you know, is very successful, completely self-made. And I watched the sacrifices that he made to get to where he is, and not even from a sports performance. I mean, the man played basketball every morning at the local gym, but showing up and working hard. And every promotion that I've gotten in jiu-jitsu, my coach has echoed that sentiment. And, you know, as he tied my purple belt around my waist, he's like, this is someone who is not athletically talented, right? This is not someone that it just comes easily to, but this is someone that works really, really hard. So I got that from my dad. My jiu-jitsu coach is also my business partner. We own the gym together, and he is incredible. And I think that's kind of telling to my perspective in life. It's not some professional athlete that I look up to and say I want to be like them. It's the people that are in my circle kind of loving and supporting me regardless of if I fail or win. And that's my dream, is to stand on the world stage for jiu-jitsu, having a gold medal around my neck and saying, I didn't kill myself to get here, right? Because that's the traditional sport perspective. You have to kill yourself. You have to sacrifice. Yes, I embrace challenges. Yes, I work very hard. I spend about, you know, 20 hours in the gym working on myself, not even including teaching classes and stuff like that. And so I work hard, I show up, and I really let that shine through. And then from the practice perspective, I was really lucky to work with an awesome mentor. My schooling came out of the University of Western States, but it was actually all online. And my mentor was in Australia, which was super cool. His name was Dr. Condi. And he gave me a lot of the nudges towards the way that I can support athletes in the unique way that I have to, right? I do work with a lot of equestrian athletes. And so when I think about sports psychology in general, there's a lot of, you know, getting control of your thoughts and working with rational versus irrational thoughts. And so when I was faced with an athlete that says, I'm afraid I'm going to die. And the rationality is, you know, like that's a risk that comes with the sport. I've had to make a lot of adaptations in my practice. So he was wonderful. And then I read a lot of memoirs from athletes. I mean, if you want to go towards task-oriented athlete, John Wooden literally had his athletes like put on their socks in a certain way, right? What more can you be completely in control of? Like, I'm going to make sure they put on their socks correctly so that they don't get blisters. And, you know, I've read almost every like high performance book that there is. One of my favorites and one of my most influential is actually one that I read somewhat recently. And it's called The Inner Game of Tennis, but it's very applicable to all sports. And it really talks about how letting go of the need to win helps you open up, think, process, and do all the things that you need to do to be successful. So those are some of my takes on that.
Hello, everyone. I hope you guys have enjoyed these last two episodes of Chat by the Pitch. Tyler brings so much insight at such a young age, and I really do appreciate everything she shared and everything she said. As we chatted more throughout this episode, I do have to apologize. I ate up a good chunk of the time, and I'm sorry. But what she talked about when she did share her insights and her views on everything, it's unbelievable when she talked about high-performing athletes, and that's what we compare our kids to. We aren't comparing our kids to themselves or realistic models, role models for them. I look at this as where my kid was last June to this June, or where was he 2 months ago to where he is today? Is he putting the effort in? My daughter with her gymnastics, is she doing the things she can do at home? My son, is he practicing every day to get himself to the next level? Is my daughter getting on her balance beam or her bar to get better every day? Are they wanting to do it? Are we pushing it? What is the case? And as we look at our players, our behavior, I talked about myself with my son and my antics and celebrating the great moments, encouraging when he's low, and trying to help him be the best Landon or my daughter, the best Thea, each one of them the best they can be, and not comparing them to other kids, because every kid grows at a different rate. Every player has their own struggles. And if we can teach them to be stronger mentally and teach them to be not just a good person on the pitch, but off the pitch, and these life skills of building mental toughness and giving them the chance to visualize what is going on is so important for them to grow, not just with school. She talked about that being able to see in your mind what you're capable of doing. If we have our kids go out there and they can't visualize in their mind them doing a Maradona or a body faint or a scissors or even a great pass, how can we expect them to be successful in real life? Using the visualization technique of going through a game or going through moments, and it's okay to have failure, and teaching that it's okay to have failure. As we progress our players, it's up to us to find what is the best avenue for them to grow. And sometimes it's not the easy route, and sometimes it's not the easy answer, and sometimes it is. It is taking the moment and figuring out what is the best thing for our player to grow. And as we get ready for this upcoming season to happen, or the next season, or whatever game may be up, be their place of positive reinforcement. It's okay to share what's going on and your concerns for them, but also be honest. If we can't be honest with our players, what's the point of giving feedback? It is setting them up to be successful, not just on the pitch, but when they leave the pitch. And they may never leave the pitch, but when they start a career, whatever it may be, that they can be successful. If they go off to college, or if they're in high school, being successful in high school and understanding that most people just want what's best for them. There's a lot of people rooting for our players. Let's remember that we are the influence that can make these changes and help build them up to be the next best player. If we just take the time. Hey, everyone. If you guys have enjoyed this podcast, have enjoyed what I've been trying to do, the messages that I'm putting out there, please give me some ratings, some stars on all the podcast sites that you listen to this on. Give me a review, share this, share with others. The more I can make this grow, the more I can continue doing this. I'm really trying to make a difference in our soccer community. So I hope you guys have enjoyed all this. And until next time, I'll see you at the pitch.